So for many people, the idea of compassion or the feeling of compassion comes in their mind only when they see somebody having physical suffering or extreme mental suffering. In other words, they think of dukkha in the very common way that all human beings and all animals don't like physical and mental pain and agony. So that's one type of compassion, but it's also a very limited type of compassion because it only has compassion for people who are obviously right now in physical or mental pain. Whereas the whole idea of dukkha, when talking about the first two truths, true dukkha, true origin of dukkha, the meaning of dukkha goes much, much deeper than just that obvious pain. It also includes the dukkha of change, which we usually call happiness, and the pervasive dukkha of conditioning, just having a body and mind under the control of afflictions and karma. And most people don't see those latter two types of dukkha. They don't think of it at all. And instead they look around, and when they and their friends are happy and successful and things are going well, then they think, I'm happy. There's no understanding of dukkha in their minds at that time, no understanding of what it means to be trapped in samsara. And so when you think about this, you know, that kind of ignorance and how that limits our ability, because it's not like we're aware all the time that we're in samsara, and it's not like we're aware all the time of the last two types of dukkha. But we get in this ignorant, very numb state, and then think that everything's okay. Yeah. As long as there's no excruciating pain or anything really going bad, then samsara isn't too bad. Of course, we could tweak it a little bit, make it better, but, you know, good enough. And that attitude prevents us from really practicing because we don't have any aspiration to attain liberation, let alone full awakening, when we think that our samsara is good enough. So we need to really remind ourselves of this a lot and frequently. And when we look around and see most sentient beings totally ignorant of existing in samsara and what that means and what it entails and what the prognosis is. Yeah, seeing that situation should make rise a lot of compassion in our mind. Because here are all these beings who mean well and have no idea of their situation, and so can't do anything to remedy it at all. And so they just march towards death and rebirth again and again and again. So it takes courage to look at that level of dukkha and to acknowledge it. But when we do, then the feeling of compassion really changes. And we realize how crucial it is that we do something to help sentient beings, and how we can only do that in the best way when we've completely eliminated our own hindrances and obscurations and developed all good qualities. And so it's on that base that we generate bodhicitta and engage in the 10 perfections. So generate that motivation now. I did look, and Goenkaji has great reverence and respect for the Buddha, and he says that his type of vipassana comes from the Buddha, but he's also very strong in saying that the Buddha did not teach a religion. He taught a science of mind. So it doesn't seem like he says he's a Buddhist in the sense of belonging to a religion. He really doesn't like that kind of thing at all. That's one point. And then another one here is somebody is asking, you know, about why the Buddha is called an arhat, because also in the prayer for taking the 8 Mahayana precepts, he's called an arhat. In our chanting at the beginning here, he's an arhat. So we have to remember that in different Buddhist traditions, some words have different meanings, and that the meanings of some words, for example, like arhat, changed over time with some people, okay? So in the early years, when the early sutras were really broadly promulgated, then there wasn't much difference between a Buddha and an arhat, okay? There wasn't the idea of afflictive obscurations and also cognitive obscurations. Rather, the Buddha was seen as a human being. He practiced the path. He attained liberation. What was different about him than the other arhats was that he was a wheel-turning Buddha, which means that he taught the Dharma at a historical time when it didn't exist in the world. Yeah, and so he was distinguished in that way. And, he was just a very, very outstanding person. But later on, when the Mahayana teachings began to be spread more widely, then, in the Mahayana sutras, they made a difference between a Buddha and an arhat. Okay, and so you get it that way. In the chanting that we do, and in the precept prayer, both of those are coming from the very early Buddhist teachings. Yeah, in fact, in the Pali tradition, there. Praise to the Buddha is almost exactly like the one that we chant. When the prayer that they do when they take one day precepts, they don't take it with the Mahayana motivation, but they take the same 8 precepts with the motivation for liberation. the you know, verses that you say to take the precepts are just about exactly the same. Okay? And so you can tell these things, you know, there's a lot of harmony between the two traditions. So then on other things, you know, ideas about certain things changed, you know, the meaning of selflessness changed in some of the scriptures as time went on, like that. Okay? So it feels like the air con is on in here, doesn't it? So see it as an opportunity to use up karma to be born in the hell realms. Okay? No, I'm serious. This is the best way to see it instead of, you know, like, oh, this is terrible. I'm freezing. I can't sit here. Why can't I wear sleeves? I want to wear sleeves. What's the use of being here, not being able to wear sleeves? You know, so instead of having your mind fixated on that for the next hour and a half, just say, okay, I'm purifying karma to be born in the hell realms, the cold hells. Yeah. And then this cold that we're feeling right now, it's doable. So I see half of you sitting here like this. Okay. So let's continue where we left off, talking about the Buddha's life. So this is something I always like. I find the Buddha's life story very, very inspiring. Because it's very close to our lives in many ways. We may not have been the son of a prince or the son of a king, you know, but I think growing up even middle class in America, you know, we have quite a good life. And so it involves that same thing that the Buddha went through of, okay, your life is good and you can have sense pleasure, but what else is there in life? Okay, so the Buddha's life. I don't care if you pay attention to me, but you should pay attention to the story of the Buddha's life. Buddhism in our world began with Shakyamuni Buddha, who in the view common to all Buddhists, was born Siddhartha Gautama, a prince from the Sakya clan, most likely in the 5th century BCE, near what is today the India-Nepali border. Okay. So you'll hear this phrase, common to all the Buddhists, or common to all Buddhist traditions. Okay, because there's many different things where there is a view that everybody holds in common, and then there is a view unique to the Prasangikas, or unique to the Mahayana. Okay, so here we're just talking about the Buddha's life as it's seen in a very ordinary way. I think I mentioned last time how some people think in the Mahayana that the Buddha got elevated to a god. You know, but here, looking at his life, we're just seeing him as an ordinary being. Okay? Yeah, in the Mahayana, they say he was already enlightened before, and then he appeared as an ordinary being. Yeah. But the story that's common is he was an ordinary being, and this is how he lived and what happened. Okay. So his kind heart and great intelligence were evident from childhood. Despite a sheltered life in the palace, he ventured into the town, where for the first time he saw a sick person, an old person, and a corpse. Okay? Do you think we had some sheltered lives? You know, in terms of, you know, if you think of growing up in India now, then seeing the poverty, growing up in Syria, yeah, did we have a comparatively sheltered life? Okay. A how many of us, how many people have never seen a corpse? Yeah. So it's we hide death away very much in our culture. And when we do see it, the person's all made up, so they look very beautiful. One of my friends, when her mother died, we were both about 18 at the time, and I heard people at the funeral say, "Oh, I haven't seen her look so nice in a long time." When they, you know, they had an open casket because she had been so sick before. Okay, so this prompted him to reflect on the suffering living beings experience. And after seeing a wandering mendicant, he aspired to be free from the cycle of constantly recurring problems called samsara. Disillusioned with the pleasures of palace life and seeking liberation, at the age of 29, he left his family and royal position, shed his elegant clothing, and adopted the lifestyle of a wandering mendicant. Okay. Did we get disillusioned with samsara? Were we actually disillusioned with samsara? Or were we unhappy and looking for happiness? Because there's a difference in there, you know? Did we have any idea of what samsara was? Or were we just, sometimes wondering what the meaning of life was, or wondering, you know, how to be happy in our chaotic world? Okay. But there was something that wasn't sitting well with us. Okay. Did we shed our elegant clothing? Or did we get all the right kind of yoga clothes and Dharma clothes to wear? You know, in the Dharma magazines, how there's all these advertisements for how you should dress when you go to Dharma class. And, and they have all these dating things they advertise in the Dharma magazines. So you can meet, Mr. Buddha. And fall in love while the teacher's talking about the disadvantages of attachment. Okay, so Siddhartha studied and mastered the meditation techniques of the great teachers of his time, but he saw that they did not bring freedom from cyclic existence. For 6 years, he practiced severe asceticism, but realizing that torturing the body doesn't tame the mind, he relinquished this for the middle path of keeping the body healthy without indulging in sense pleasure. How many of you have been to the place near Bodh Gaya where the Buddha meditated for those 6 years, practicing austerity? It's quite moving being there. Yeah. And then you think when he got it clear in his mind, you know, this is not the path to Buddhahood. And he left, how all of his friends made fun of him. They said he was a flake. He copped out. He was taking the easy path. So you think of the social pressure that he had. Yeah. And how he had to break away from that group because the way of practice wasn't leading to the awakening that he sought. Sitting under the Bodhi tree in what is present-day Bodh Gaya, India, he determined to arise only after attaining full awakening. On the full moon of the fourth lunar month, the Buddhist holiday of Vaisakh, he completed the process of cleansing his mind of all obscurations and developing all good qualities and became a Buddha, a fully awakened one. 35 years old at that time, he spent the next 45 years teaching what he had discovered through his own experience to whomever came to hear. Okay. So he taught to the people who came. He didn't, have an advertising network that went ahead of him announcing. I mean, there was word of mouth and everything, but I don't think there was a claim, this is the one and only, this is your one chance to meet this person, highly realized, you know, you create great merit by giving an offering, make sure you bring money. Yeah. Okay. I don't think that went on quite like that at that time. When you read the Pali Canon, it's really beautiful. You get a sense of the Buddha as a human being and what he was like. And, you know, he was very low key, but he was also very direct and straightforward. Okay. So he, when people were monkeying around, he would ask questions and kind of really help them to see what they were doing. And he talked to everybody. I mean, lots of times he would, because of his super knowledges, he could see what different groups of people were talking about or what they were discussing. And so sometimes it would be his disciples, sometimes it would be Nirganthas, the Jains, disciples, or other, you know, the matted hair ascetic disciples. And so he would, on his way to collect alms, go over and say to them, venerables, what are you talking about? And then they would share with him what they were talking about. And then he would ask them more questions and wind up giving a discourse, which was a sutra. Okay. So he would just, discuss all these, philosophical and practical topics with anybody, It wasn't, you're a born-again Christian, I'm staying away from you. Or you're a what, whatever kind of person we don't like to talk to because we find them obnoxious, The Buddha was not like that. On the other hand, he didn't hang around and talk with people who weren't open either. Yeah. If somebody wasn't open, he just said good day and moved on. The Buddha taught men and women of all ages, races, and social classes. Royalty, beggars, merchants, officials, thieves, farmers, musicians, and prostitutes. So he didn't leave anybody out. Yeah. So it wasn't like, today where people are so often, banded with the people that think like them. Yeah. So at one of the Buddhist talks, you might find many, many different kinds of people from different social classes coming together. Although, knowing how the Indians were about caste, I bet they had different seating areas, Okay. Many of his students chose to relinquish the householder's life and adopt the monastic life, and thus the Sangha community of ordained beings was born. As his followers attained realization and became skilled in teaching the Dharma, he asked them to share with others what they had realized for the welfare of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of gods and humans. So that passage is a stock passage that comes in many, many sutras whenever the Buddha sent his disciples out. Yeah. That wasn't the way my teachers did it. My first assignment, I remember how I got the message. I was sitting at Gabon drinking tea in the afternoon, and one nun walked by and saw me, and then she turned back and, to talk to me. And she said, "A Lama thinks it would be very good if you went to the Italian Dharma Center and work there." And so, you know, get ready to leave and you'll be going soon. And then she kept walking. You know, I wish, you know, it would have made a huge difference to me if she had said, for the welfare of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude. Yeah, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of gods and humans. You know, because it's important that we set our motivation and know why we're being sent somewhere. And it was just, well, they need somebody there, so you're going. Yeah. And another time when they wanted me to go somewhere, you know, one monk came to see me and it was, well, if you don't go, the Dharma Center is going to close. Yeah, and it didn't work, you know. He was trying to make me feel bad. And I thought, if my not going means that the Dharma Center would close, then there's nothing there to keep open to start with, you know. Because if one person not going is going to make the difference between open and closed, there's nothing there. So I didn't go. Huh? I what?
Did you send your
clothes? I didn't send my clothes.
Did the Dharma send your clothes?
Oh no, it's prospering. It's doing very well. I went to visit. I was in that country last year, the year before I went to visit it. It was doing fine. Great Dharma Center. Yeah, it didn't depend on me. Okay. But yeah. And I didn't go because I had just requested teachings from another teacher in Dharamsala, and it would have been not very good after requesting teachings and starting those to go in and say, I'm leaving. You know, you don't do that. So, okay. Thus, the Buddha's teachings spread throughout the Indian subcontinent, and in subsequent centuries to present day Sri Lanka, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, China, Korea, Japan, Central Asia, Tibet, Mongolia, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. In recent years, Dharma centers have opened in locations all around the world. I don't think there's one in Antarctica. Anybody volunteering to go? Okay, you to Antarctica next week. Okay, teach the penguins. Personally speaking, this is His Holiness. Personally speaking, I feel a deep connection to Shakyamuni Buddha, as well as profound gratitude for his teachings and the example of how he lived his life, abiding in the pure ethical conduct of a monastic and sharing the teachings impartially. Okay, that's what His Holiness is especially admiring. Okay, living in pure ethical conduct of a monastic and sharing the teachings impartially. The Buddha had insights into the workings of the mind that were previously unknown on the earth. He taught that our experiences of happiness and suffering are intricately related to our minds and emotions. Suffering is not thrust upon us by other people. It is a product of our ignorant views and beliefs. Happiness is not a gift from the gods. It is a result of our own cultivation of wisdom and compassion. The Buddha's life is a teaching in itself. He questioned the meaning of worldly life and reached the decision to practice the Dharma while facing pressure from his family and society to inherit the kingship. Yeah, so his dad wanted him to go into the family business. And he had a lot of pressure from his parents to live a certain life. And they had gotten, you know, made sure he got married to a woman, an appropriate woman from the appropriate class, who, of course, was beautiful. They, you know, they don't say much about her intelligence, but you could tell she was intelligent. She became a nun later on. But, yeah, but, you know, as the old tales go, you know, the main quality was she had to be beautiful. So he had everything that you were supposed to have, and then he just saw that the whole thing was useless. Yeah. Despite the hardships he encountered, he practiced diligently and did not give up until he had attained full awakening. He dealt compassionately with the people who berated him or criticized his teachings. Oh my goodness. Yeah? Do we deal compassionately with people who berate us and criticize what we believe in or what we teach? Or do we get defensive? Yeah. So you can see, just, you know, why I'm saying this is so that we can look at how the holy beings live their lives. Because lots of times we think learning the Dharma means studying a text. Yeah, and learning the outline, memorizing the points. But sometimes, if we're very astute, we learn by watching. Okay? And in this case, you know, watching how the Buddha lived. Now, how did he make decisions? How did he decide what to do? How did he guide other people? And by really looking at how he handled situations, then that gives us an idea of how to put Dharma in practice in our daily lives. Okay? And I think that's quite important to see that living example. Because it's so easy otherwise just to think, okay, well, I studied this text, and, you know, it has three main outlines, and the first outline has four sub-outlines, and the first point of that has 3 points, and et cetera. Yeah, which is beautiful, and it's good, and we need to study the text, but that isn't the only way you learn. And I'm saying this because I think sometimes as Westerners, we're a little bit, what would be a good word? Out of it. In other words, you know, we could learn so much by observing, but we don't observe. Yeah, we're caught up in our own heads with our likes and our dislikes and our opinions and everything like that, instead of really watching, you know, and looking around and, you know, how do, you know, the people who are really good practitioners, how do they live and what do? And how do they deal with situations? Yeah. And this really came home to me when I had gone to Taiwan to take Bhikshuni ordination, because there was no translation, basically, for the first 2 weeks, a little bit in our room. And then after that, there's a little bit of translation, but again, not much. And so I had to watch in order to know what to do. Okay? And I didn't understand what it was I was learning, but I knew that I had to do the same thing as everybody else, and nobody was going to tell me in English what to do. Yeah? So, and you're taught that you cannot look around, you know? Your eyes have to be down, you know? So, and you have to sit and hold yourself in a certain way, but out of the side of your eye, you know? Are we supposed to kneel down? Are we supposed to stand now? How am I supposed to hold my hands? What do I do with my robe? And you can't look at the person next to you. Anyway, there were only 2 of us who were foreigners, who were non-Chinese at that ordination of like over 500 people. And the one next to me was another foreigner, so she didn't know what she was doing. So I couldn't look at her, you know. So I kind of tried looking this way and tried looking in front of me. And But it really made me see that there's a whole way to learn just by observing, okay? And when you do that, very often you have to put your opinions to the side because you realize that you don't understand what's going on and why people are doing what they're doing. And if you let your opinion factory go, you are going to get really bent out of shape. Okay. So it's good. We need to learn how to be more subtle, I think, and watch and observe. Sometimes his followers were uncooperative and belligerent, but he did not give up on them, although he sometimes had to address them sternly. Yeah, if you read the sutras, you know, if somebody's teaching a wrong view, you know, the Buddha would say, you know, you foolish person, you know, haven't you heard what the teachings are? And, I mean, he would talk like that to somebody. Can you imagine the Buddha talking to you like that? What you'd feel like? The sutras show that he engaged with many different kinds of people with great skill and compassion, and he was completely uninterested in fame or praise. Reflecting on the kindness of the Buddha for providing teachings that suit the various dispositions and interests of the variety of sentient beings, I feel deep reverence. I hope that you too, by learning and practicing the Buddha's teachings, will develop this sense of personal connection with our teacher, the Buddha. Okay, now there's the section on early Buddhist schools. Okay. So the historical evolution of Buddhism is a fluid and dynamic process that brought forth various schools, traditions, and tenet systems. Okay. So we have to remember, you know, and here I think Goenkaji is right. The Buddha had no intention of founding a religion. I don't think any of the great, you know, people from any spiritual tradition had a motivation to start a religion and a religious institution. Yeah, I think all that was done by their followers. Okay, but they themselves, they were too busy practicing and benefiting others. Okay, but here, you know, it starts out, it was the development of Buddhism was fluid and dynamic. Yeah. When I first started learning, you know, I was told we are learning exactly what the Buddha taught, you know. And I think the meaning that we were learning, you know, was faithfully passed down. But what I didn't realize at the time is that the way it was being presented was influenced by the culture and the way decisions were made in terms of many Vinaya things were influenced by the climate and, you know, nobody said anything like that. So I thought everything that I learned from living in the Tibetan community was Buddhist. I didn't know how to differentiate, you know, Tibetan culture and Tibetan politics and so on from the Dharma. Yeah. And so it really took me a while, and I had to draw a lot because I studied humanities in college, you know, to really go back and think, oh no, this, you know, it is fluid and dynamic and it's changing in different historical areas, eras. And so hopefully the teachings are not changing, but how things look on superficially, they're going to change. Yeah. I mean, just even look how we're sitting now. Yeah. If this were a Tibetan teacher, we wouldn't have people sitting around in chairs. Everybody would be on the floor. Yeah, you go to a teaching with His Holiness, everybody's on the floor. Yeah, maybe recently one or two geshis maybe who were like in their 70s or 80s sat in a chair. But, you know, So just, you know, just even things like that. There would, you know, if we were in India, there wouldn't be a camera sitting there, you know, and like that. You'd be sitting probably in your teacher's rooms on mats. Your teacher would be sitting on his bed. Okay. Yeah, because in the monasteries, you know, you don't go to another room for teachings. You just, you know, your bedroom is also your living room, your kitchen, your dining room. It's where everything happens. Yeah. And so you go to your teacher's room to receive teachings, and they are sitting on their bed, and you sit on the floor, and yeah, and that's the way it is. We may speak of one school or another as if it were as if they were distinct entities with clear boundaries. However, Buddhism on the ground was not so clear. We see this even today with Theravada monastics who take the Bodhisattva precepts, practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism who are ordained in the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya lineage followed in Taiwan, Chinese monastics practicing insight meditation as taught in the Pali tradition, and so on. Okay? So there's lots of things happening now that would not have happened before. I think especially in the West, where you have so many Buddhist traditions coming together, yeah, that didn't come together before. I say the West, but in Singapore it was the same way. And I don't know, maybe even more so in Singapore, because there were so many Buddhists, so you really got to know other traditions and other teachers. Okay. It is important to keep in mind when discussing Buddhist history that we can't say for sure what happened in the past. Okay, remember that. In our present lives, our memory of a specific event differs from that of the person standing next to us. History appears differently according to our perspective. Each person selects certain details to focus on, and the interpretation of those details varies from person to person. Despite the subjectivity of history, it is nevertheless useful to have a general knowledge of the historical background of the Dharma that we study. Okay, so it's helpful to have that general knowledge, but at the same time realize that we're going to learn one version and other people are going to have other versions. And, you know, and that's going to be okay. Or we can fight about it if we want to, but, you know, I would advise using our time in another way. After the Buddha's passing, or parinirvana, the arhat, Mahakasyapa, gathered 500 arhats together at Rajgriha to recite the Buddha's discourses at what came to be called the First Council. Okay, so he had them recite the Vinaya and the sutras, and then the Abhidharma, we'll get to this, but everybody has a different idea about the origins of the Abhidharma. Okay, so that's a whole other topic. In the early centuries, these sutras were passed down orally, principally by Banikas. It must be because it's a long A, Banikas. Monastics whose duty it was to memorize and recite the scriptures. Each group of Banikas was assigned a group of scriptures, and for many centuries, every successive generation of Banikas memorized the texts and taught them to others. Although the Buddha did not repeat verbatim every talk he gave on a particular topic, passages on certain important themes were standardized for ease in memorization. Thus, there are stock passages and phrases and some almost identical sutras in the Nikayas of the Pali Canon and in the Agamas of the Chinese Canon. Okay, so the Nikayas are big collections of sutras. And the Agamas are also big collections of the same of the sutras that are very similar to those in the Pali Nikaya. Okay, so there are some people now who can take a sutra found in Pali, and then they find the corresponding Agama, and then they compare the two because they're clearly from the same source. But of course, being passed down orally, you know, there's sometimes different variations, and so they do that. So the Chinese canon is very big in this way. You know, it shares, it has, I think, almost all of the Pali canon, except maybe one of the Nikayas, something like that. But it shares a whole lot of material with the Pali tradition. Plus, the Chinese canon has a huge amount of Mahayana material and a little bit of Tantra. Yeah. The Tibetan canon has mostly sutras and tantras, and then a collection, a lot of the commentaries and treatises by the Indians. The Tibetan canon doesn't have so many sutras that are exactly the same as the Nikayas or the Agamas, you know. And this can have to do with the time period when Buddhism was introduced to these places, because Buddhism went to China starting in the 1st century BC, yeah, and so, you know, it had all these early sutras that had been passed down, went to China fairly early on. Buddhism didn't go into Tibet until the 6th century, so like almost 1,000 years after the Buddha lived. So by that time, there was many more commentaries. The tantras were very popular, okay? And so a lot of different texts went into Tibet, then went into China, you know, then went into Sri Lanka, okay? So you have these different collections in the canons. And plus, over time, you know, it wasn't like all the sutras came at once. It's like, okay, here's your delivery, you know, 554,000 sutras, you know. They didn't all come at once. They came over a period of time. Then you had the translation process going on and different people selecting which sutras to translate and then how to translate them. And so different people translating things in different ways, and so you know, you're going to get different meanings. Yeah, so, and then, like I said, what was really prominent in India at the time when Buddhism went to a place made a huge difference. You know, Buddhism started going into Sri Lanka, I think 3rd century BC, yeah, so they received, you know, one whole set of sutras. China, it started going in, you know, a few hundred centuries, you know, a couple, two, three, four centuries later. And so, you know, going into China, so it got many of the sutras that went into Sri Lanka, and then it got all these new Mahayana sutras that were, you know, had been hidden in the early days, but now we're being spread out and practiced. Then you had different people going to India to bring back sutras. Yeah, you know, the Chinese love telling the story of Xuanzang. It's even a fable, isn't it? You know, he went with a pig and a monkey, didn't he? You know, those were his traveling companions as he walked across the Gobi Desert to, you know, and cross the mountains and got to India. And then, you know, there were other people. Some people came by the sea route. Some people, you know, came over the Karakoram Mountains. There's, you know, and so depending where they went in India, what sutras they found there, yeah, And then they would just stack up a whole bunch of sutras. You see the picture of Xuanzang. And, you know, he doesn't have a nice, you know, backpack like people have nowadays. It's some old frame made probably of bamboo, I think. And just these texts piled one on top. And the texts are made of leaves, yeah, or bark. And then they're walking, you know. They couldn't wrap them up and, you know, send them by UPS. Yeah, they had to carry them. They had to protect them. They walked. Can you imagine walking over the mountains and over the desert from India to get, you know, to places in China, or taking the sea route to go to Sri Lanka or Indonesia, or, you know, Buddhism went to China also by the sea route. You know, it's amazing what these people did. Yeah, totally amazing. And they just collected whatever they possibly could and brought it back. And then different people would look at it. It's like, let's see what you have here. And, you know, and then some people would start translating it. And you got different groups of translators and different schools and so on. But it's really something extraordinary when you think about it. You know, what people went through in the past to bring Dharma there. And then also going to Tibet. I mean, there you had to cross the Himalayas. And, you know, that certainly wasn't easy. So, yeah. So, but people, my point is, what sutras you got in a particular country depended on what was going on in India at the time somebody from your country went to India and collected sutras, you know, because Buddhism developed in India. It wasn't like, okay, you know, here the Buddha said this and then that was it, you know, because right away after the Buddha taught, you had all these people writing the commentaries. And so that's one idea of how the Abhidharma came to be, because people were studying the sutras. And then, you know, they're trying to organize the material because the Buddha talked of so many different things. And then they have their own ideas about things. And so they would write these treatises and get into these details about, you know, kind of, you talk about this and it has five kinds and this overlaps with this. And one moment of this kind of mind has actually, you know, 15 different sub-mind moments, and this is what goes on in each one of them. And, I mean, it's amazing what these Abhidharmikas did. Yeah, try reading an Abhidharma text sometime. You know, it's not for, you know, leisurely reading. Yeah. Kind of when you're tired, I think I'll sit down, relax, and read the Abhidharma tonight. No, it's, you know, it's pretty intense stuff. Okay. Yeah, so you had all this going on. It was really amazing when you think about it. Okay. Okay, and then also, like I was saying here, you know, if you look in the Pali Canon, because you can tell it was really passed down orally for many centuries, because there are so many standardized phrases and standardized passages, you know. And so they did that because then that made it so much easier when you had to recite something. And so if you look in some of the Nikayas, especially in the connected sutras, the Samyutta Nikaya, then you know, there's some sutras that are almost identical, except the Buddha spoke them to different people. Yeah, but, you know, the Banaka would realize, you know, memorize one, and then he would just change the name it was spoken to for the rest, because the passage was standardized. Yeah, so, you know, of course, we know the Buddha didn't say exactly the same thing whenever he taught a certain subject. So already from the beginning, things were getting edited. Yeah. But it was really important, you know, passing it down orally like that. And then they would have people who would check. You know, if one person was reciting it, somebody else would check, who also knew it by heart, to make sure that that person was reciting it correctly and didn't leave anything out or didn't add anything. So you had the different panakas checking each other. But then also you can see, when you compare texts that went to different parts of the globe, that, yeah, there were certain things that changed, yeah, and got added. Usually it seems like things got added, yeah, more than subtracted, and probably added because people wanted to explain more, yeah. I'm thinking that it's kind of like, you know how when we're studying a text and we'll see a quoted passage, and if the translator has done it like really literally, there will be brackets with the words that the translator inserted so that you could understand the meaning of the verse better. But imagine, you know, if somebody just says, well, let's just, you know, it's so weird reading something with all these brackets. Let's just take the brackets out and make it easier to read. And then they did that, and then that got passed down without people realizing that material had gotten added, okay, because the brackets had been taken out. Okay, so things probably, you know, happened. It was done orally, probably happened something like that. But when you think of that, it's amazing how similar the teachings are in the different traditions, especially if you compare the Vinaya. You know, yeah, there's different things, and sometimes how the precepts are worded are different. But when you can think that for centuries these things were passed down orally, it's totally remarkable how similar they are. Yeah. And you think of our ability to memorize now. Yeah, we weren't taught that in school, were we? We were taught how to find information we wanted, you know, how to look in the library, or now I guess how to Google something. But still in the monasteries, I mean, when you go to the Tibetan monasteries, from the time the little kids enter, they're learning, they memorize. They have no clue at all of the meaning of what they're memorizing, yeah? Because some of the root texts, they're not in clear sentences, you know. They're just kind of a string of words that, you know, maybe are a list or maybe parts of a sentence, or, you know, because so much of it is put in verse form, because if it's, you know, you have seven syllables to a line or nine syllables to a line, then it's easier to memorize. Yeah, but the little kids from the very beginning, you know, they go in, they're memorizing all that stuff. I can't imagine taking a Western child and having them memorize stuff they didn't understand. You know, having that kind of discipline. Some of you have been, you know, stayed in the monasteries in India, and you know what it's like. You know, you get up in the morning and you hear the little kids chanting. Before you go to bed at night, they're chanting, they're reciting their stuff. You know, Western kids, you know, they're there with their, you know, their tablets, doing everything. And of course, now this is becoming a problem in the monasteries. The kids are getting phones and things like that. It's becoming difficult. But, you know, Western kids, get them to sit still and memorize. I don't know. Yeah. What do you think? Would you have done that when you were a kid? Yeah. All I memorized was, you know, songs I liked on the radio and you know, commercial jingles. Those got memorized without trying. Yeah. I had to memorize my phone number, so if I got lost, and my address, you know. But aside from that, It wasn't, memorizing was not a prized skill when I was a kid. And I don't think now it is either. But there it is. And even today, when you go for your Geshe exam, one chunk of your Geshe exam is you have to recite a text, a big text, very quickly, without making any errors, in front of the whole, hundreds of other monks in the prayer hall. You ready? Yeah. Whew. But they really value that. And so that's one way you earn a lot of respect in the monasteries is if you can memorize a lot. Yeah. In our culture, it's not valued much. Yeah. People respect you more if you have money. Of course, in the monasteries, they respect you more if you have money too. Okay. A famine in the first century BCE threatened the continued existence of the scriptures in present-day Sri Lanka, propelling the monks to preserve them in written form. During this time, other groups of Banakas continued to orally disseminate the Buddhist discourses in many other parts of India. In the centuries following the Second Council in 382 BCE, a variety of different Buddhist sects appeared. It is said 18 in all. Now, this is what's very interesting. Okay, most of the traditions for the description of the First Council is very similar, with Mahakasapa calling it, and Upali reciting the Vinaya, and Ananda reciting the sutras, and so on. Okay, when you come to the history, of what happened at the Second Council, there are very different versions. Some people say that that there was a schism, and that was the start of the Mahayana. That there was one group that broke away called the Mahasanghikas, and they became the present-day Mahayanas. And the reason there was the schism was because the monks in, was it Vasali? Or someplace that started with a P, I can't remember. Anyway, there were monks in one place, and they were doing some things that there was dispute about whether it was legal to do those things according to Vinaya. Such things as store your salt in a ram's horn. Okay. Yeah. And handle money. Handle money, I think, was a one that needed to be talked about. But storing, where you stored your salt, I don't know. So it was things like that, from the Vinaya. And so some people said that's where the split happened, because there were two groups and they called in some monks from another place, and those monks, said, okay, you guys have the right understanding and you have the wrong understanding. And there was a schism, okay? So some people say that happened at the Second Council. Other people say the Second Council was not about, storing your salt and handling money. It was about the notion of an arhat. And could you become an arhat and then degenerate and back into an ordinary being? And did arhats have, it was more doctrinal, did arhats have desire? Did arhats, could you fall down from being an arhat? So there, a very different description of what was going on in the Second Council. Yeah. And then, of course, you had more councils after that. And the Theravadas have kept having councils. I think the last one was maybe 1956, something like that. Yeah, but of course, they didn't invite all the Mahayana people because there was a schism you know, back at the Second Council in 383 BCE. And yeah. Okay. So it was after that Second Council, that's what they said, that that's when the 18 schools appeared. There is more than one list of the 18, and each list classifies the major schools and their branches differently. Okay. But in any case, there was clearly a great profusion of Buddhist lineages in the Indian subcontinent and nearby areas as well. Many factors influenced the development of these different Shravaka schools: location, climate, language, culture, and the availability of sutras and teachings, to mention a few. Since the sutras were passed down orally and the groups were separated by great distances, each school developed slightly different versions of the Tripitaka, the three baskets of Vinaya Sutra and Abhidharma texts, although the majority of the material was shared in common. So what we have now, the only of these 18 schools, we only have the Theravada, the Mula Srivastavada, and the Dharmaguptaka. Yeah. In terms of the Vinaya, you know, there's different, like I was saying, with the sutras, you know, the Pali and the Chinese share many sutras, the Chinese and the Tibetans share many. So, and then in terms of the Abhidharma, it's very interesting. The Pali, what is it? The Pali have seven Abhidharma sutras, Abhidharma texts. And I think it's either the Chinese or the Tibetans, maybe it comes further on here, have seven also Abhidharma texts, but they're not the same. They each have seven, but the seven are different. Okay. So, so you have, you know, because of geography, you had things developing quite differently in different areas. And then, of course, you know, so much of this was lost because, you know, if it wasn't passed down orally, then it was written on, you know, on leaves, and which decayed. Aside from some basic information, little is known about many of these 18 plus schools. While they surely debated with each other, Buddhist sects and schools, by and large, maintained friendly relations. The names of some of these 18 schools are today preserved in the three extant lineages of monastic precepts: the Theravada, which is descended from the Stavira sect, and the Mahavihara Monastery in Sri Lanka; the Mula Srivastavada, which is a branch descending from the Sarvastivada; and the Dharmaguptaka. In ancient times, the Theravada flourished in South and Southeast Asia. The Sarvastivada was located primarily in northern India and Kashmir, although it did go into China too. And the Dharmaguptaka was prominent in Gandhara and Central Asia, from where it was transmitted to China. Okay. And the Mula Srivastavada, you know, was in northern India and then Kashmir, and then that went to Tibet. Indian and Sri Lankan sages began composing commentaries, unpacking the meaning of what the Buddha said in the sutras. Thus began a commentarial tradition. Some of the differences among the 18 schools were doctrinal. Others were due to people living in different climates and cultures. While the Theravada, as recorded in ancient Sri Lankan manuscripts, sees the separation into various schools as schisms within the Buddhist community, other Buddhist traditions do not. They don't see it in that way. So it's interesting now with our Theravada, Western Theravada brothers and sisters, you know, Achan Sujato is really, you know, is investigating a lot about these different age schools And I think he would like to really show that there wasn't really a schism, and that, you know, try and bring things together. So this is quite interesting, the movement now that's happening. Okay, then you have, within all of this, academic scholars, you know, who weren't practitioners, who, you know, happened upon some sutras, or they went with some merchants to China, or they tried to get to Tibet, or Alcott, you know, with the British, what is it, the British East India Company, is that what it's called? You know, going to Sri Lanka and going to places. Okay, so then you had the academic scholars previously accepted the material in the Pali Canon as older than that of the schools in northern India. Okay, because that was they first, Western scholars first met Dharma in Sri Lanka. You know, Colonel Alcott kind of was there, and he gave them all the Pali stuff, and they thought, okay, because the Pali version is, yeah, we're the one true school, and, you know, we started out from the time of the Buddha, and things have, you know, passed down exactly like that, you know, to this day. And so that's what they thought. That's what the scholars first met. That's the idea that was brought back to Western academia. Okay, however, now academic scholars are revising their view due to recent discoveries of heretofore unknown scriptures in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and China. Fragments of scriptures of some of the early schools have been found and are now being studied by scholars such as Richard Solomon and Colette Cox. These are the ones who are at UW. In the Early Buddhist Manuscripts Project at the University of Washington. Some of these scriptures go back to the 1st and 2nd century CE. Yeah. And also, they're starting to revise the date that they think that the Buddha lived. So, in some people, it used to be thought it was the 6th century. Some people are now thinking maybe the 5th century BC. Yeah. And then they're finding these texts that are earlier and earlier. And so they're narrowing the time between when they think the Buddha lived and the texts that they're finding and studying. So this is making a big change in how some of the scholars are looking at things. Of course, they have to figure out how to translate these texts. Yeah, they didn't write a nice, you know, dictionary and put it on a thumb drive and, you know, leave it in the urns at Dunhuang. You know, they didn't do that. Okay, some of these scriptures go back to the 1st and 2nd centuries CE. Considering the fragile material used for writing in those days, it is astounding that these manuscripts have survived. Really, completely amazing. And it's very interesting to hear how they find them, because when was it? I don't know if it was the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. But they started finding all these texts in Dunhuang, which is the northern part of the Gobi Desert before you go into China. And that used to be a huge, prosperous Buddhist area there. And somebody had clearly, because there are caves, there's so many caves with these astounding Buddhist statues carved, you know, inside of them. I mean, life size, a cave that, you know, is, you know, not quite this big as this room, but, you know, maybe a third of this room, and you walk in and there's life-size Buddhas. I mean, this was the kind of stuff that was going on. But somebody put some scriptures in a bunch of urns and sealed them centuries ago and left them there. They got all covered by sand, And then the British, you know, when they were exploring in there, would go and they found all these urns with these ancient scriptures. Yeah. And then they're still finding stuff in Pakistan, Afghanistan. I mean, now it's so difficult with the Taliban, but, you know, and I'm afraid that many things have gotten destroyed in recent years, but, you know, they would find stuff. Just some farmer would be plowing his field and then he'd come across something and then, you know, told somebody else who told somebody else, and then the archaeologists came and started digging, and then they find, you know, some huge thing that was there filled with scriptures. Or like when I was talking about Jambi when we were just in Indonesia, yeah, they find, you know, all these bricks and underneath. Yeah, it's amazing, you know. And that's, you know, something in the U.S. that we don't think about very much because this continent was so sparsely populated, you know, that there's some, you know, Native American material, but it, you know, it wasn't, it was very sparse. And so you don't find those things so readily here. But in other places of the world where people have lived for centuries upon centuries, then, yeah, there's all this remnants of stuff buried in the earth that we don't even know about. So while the Theravada, as recorded in ancient Sri Lankan manuscripts, sees the separation into various schools of schisms within the Buddhist community, other Buddhist traditions do not. Okay, and then I started reading academic scholars. Okay, here we are. Other scholars, such as Bhikkhu K.L. Jamajoti at the University of Hong Kong, has determined that there are Shvastivada texts that date within two or three centuries of the Buddha's life. Isn't that amazing? The results of continuing research will give us a clearer idea of the early schools and their scriptures. Looking back at their forebears, Buddhists in northern India in the medieval period said that there were four main Shravaka schools that subsumed all of the 18 schools. So this is one version of how they were classified. One was the Shvastivada school, which the text and the language they used was Sanskrit. Second was the Mahasamgika, which used a Prakrit dialect. The third was Samhitaya, which used Apabhramsa, another Prakrit dialect. And the fourth was the Stavira, which used Paishachi. Okay. Interestingly, most of the early scriptures do not self-identify as being from one or another of the 18 schools. Isn't that interesting? So modern scholars must make intelligent guesses about which school newly found manuscripts are from. Yeah, because very often, you know, they'll have the colophon, you know, it was transcribed here by so-and-so. But they wouldn't say it was from this school or that school or anything like that, yeah? So apparently they didn't think that kind of thing was so important back then. We don't know exactly how long each of the ancient schools existed and why they ceased. The schools in some areas, such as present-day Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Central Asian republics, became extinct first. They may have died out due to economic, political and social invasions, or natural disasters in their locales, or climate change. Yeah, there could be any number of reasons why things die out. The remnants of some schools may have merged with others. Because Buddhism was heavily concentrated in monasteries and not in village homes, once the monasteries were destroyed in India during the Turkic invasion in the 13th century, Buddhism all but vanished in India. While some Indian masters, such as Baba Viveka, and most Tibetans saw the 18 schools as branches of the Vibhasika philosophical system, there is little agreement about this elsewhere. The Vibhasika school is unknown in South and Southeast Asia, and the Theravada does not consider itself a branch of the Vibhasika.
Question about the Pali, like what these four main Sravaka schools, they use these different texts. None of the dialects is there's not Pali is not mentioned.
This was like very, very early on. Things were translated into Pali. I think it really got going with Buddha Gosa, you know, when he came. He was 5th century AD. Okay. So, yeah, of course, this was how we said how some of the people in northern India saw the breakdown. The Theravadas see it totally different. Yeah, it was there in their country. They would probably say from the get-go the sutras were in Pali. The commentaries were in ancient Sinhala language. You know, then Buddha Gosa, you know, when he made commentaries, he put everything together in Pali. Yeah, and that became their scriptural language. So, but we actually really don't know. And everybody has their own idea about what happened. It's quite interesting. Questions or comments so far? The next section is a bit. Yeah?
This might be a bit of a silly question, but why didn't Buddhism spread further west?
Further west?
Like after Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Yeah. Probably because the main trading routes were the Silk Road and then the sea routes. And so things were mainly brought through the trading routes. Yeah, so if there wasn't a main trading route there, you know, you didn't have I-90 kind of going across Asia, then, yeah, you had to take the back roads, you know. And it could have had to do also with the climates in those places, with the cultures in those places. Alexander the Great. Yeah, remember him? So he was Greek, wasn't he? Greek, Roman, somewhere, what? Macedonian, Greek Macedonia, okay. So he, he was bringing some Buddhist texts back. And so there's a whole period of art where the Buddha starts looking very Greek, because it went as you know into that whole area. Okay, because he had such a huge empire, that, you know, he went out and got the texts and things and captured people and brought them back and let me say one more thing. But you can really see how the politics and climate, everything can so influence things. Just as a modern day example, okay? So we sometimes think, Chinese, yeah? All Chinese have the same culture, the same language. Extremely different, you know, within China itself, so many dialects. Then you had a lot of Chinese at the end of the 19th, early 20th century, mid 20th too, leaving China, going other places because it was so poor in China. So you had, Chinese went to Taiwan, you know, around 1949, fleeing from the communists. Then they went to Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, you know, before that, like late 19th, early 20th century. But it's so interesting. You know, you go and you're with the Chinese in Taiwan, with the Chinese in Singapore, in Malaysia, they're neighboring countries, in Indonesia, neighboring countries. The whole Chinese culture is really different in all those places. Even though the people very often came from the same parts of China, you know, because in Indonesia, they turned out to be a minority. When Indonesia gained their independence, then they really stifled the Chinese culture. They made the Chinese change their names to Indonesian names. You couldn't have signposts or anything in your shops with Chinese language. So you go to the Chinese community in Indonesia, a lot of them don't speak Mandarin or dialect. They speak Bahasa Indonesian. Yeah, and then you take a boat ride and you go to Singapore and they all speak English, or Singlish, yeah, yeah. And then you drive across another causeway and you go to Malaysia, and and again they think completely differently because they're living in a predominantly Muslim country. So you can see just in one area where people are so close, there can be very different things going on, yeah, depending on the government, yeah. So it's yeah. So these things really influence, yeah. For example, in Indonesia, for a long time, Buddhism was just not very active at all for many centuries, yeah. And then they had one monk. When did he come along? In the 70s And he was the first Indonesian monk in centuries who got ordained. And then there's kind of this renaissance going on, but they really need teachers and they need to learn what the Dharma is about. So because the Muslim invasion started in Indonesia around the 14th century. Then by the 16th century, it was pretty complete. And Buddhism was really knocked out. You just had a few pockets of Buddhists here and there. And then the Chinese immigrants who were coming over to escape what was going on in China and have a better life, they are the ones who brought Buddhism to Indonesia again. Yeah. So, we always live in a world where we're influenced by the things around us. And this was one thing that was very difficult for the Tibetans, you know, because they were locked away, you know, in their snowy mountain paradise. And then, you know, they were hearing about the Chinese communists, and like, no, these people aren't going to bug us. You know, nobody comes in here. They heard about the British. Well, you know, those white coasts, they're not going to come in either. And so they just lived as they had been living for a long time. And, you know, after World War I, which they weren't involved in, but they didn't think to join the League of Nations. Yeah, if they had joined the League of Nations after World War I, everything would have been completely different. Because then when the communist Chinese occupied the country, they could have said, look, we are an independent country. We were recognized by the League of Nations. But they didn't. And the Chinese still sent in some physician who was like a guy who looked over Tibet, I don't know how to say it. But anyway, China, from their side, saw Tibet as just an outlying area. And they had these ambans, that was what they were called, stationed in Tibet. And the Chinese saw it as, you know, this was their outlying area. The Tibetans never bothered to clarify it. They never joined the League of Nations. You know, the Chinese had their ambons there. That was okay. Nobody bothered anybody. Then, you know, when the communists came in, what could they say to the rest of the world that would, you know, show that they were an independent country? Very difficult. Very difficult. Yeah. And, you know, and they weren't modernized. The 13th Dalai Lama, he was very far looking, and he had people go to India and, you know, learn things. But India was considered modern to the Tibetans in those days, you know, and learn things from the Brits. But, you know, basically, I mean, they didn't have vehicles with wheels in old Tibet. They didn't have that. They put everything on yak back. So, you know, so, and then the social system, you know, with all the monasteries owning so much land and, you know, people basically being serfs, yeah. It wasn't as bad as the Chinese made it out to be, but it also wasn't as pure as the Tibetans made it out to be either. Yeah, because there were Tibetans who joined with the Chinese to destroy the monasteries. When I was in Tibet, I heard stories about that. Yeah, and so, yeah, we always live within the outer world, and that's going to influence us. Yeah, even you're surrounded by mountains or, you know, yeah. I mean, in Tibet, you used to have all these meditators in the mountains. Nobody bothered them. Yeah. After the Chinese came in, they would go up to the mountains and drag these meditators out of their caves. Yeah. Because they said this is, you know, the opiate of the people, and they're backwards, and we've got to destroy it. Okay. So, in some ways, you know, for us, we have to be aware of how the government treats religion in this country. Yeah, to make sure that we really are able to preserve religious freedom here. Okay. Maybe we better stop. I go on and on and on and on. Okay. You had something? Okay, we'll do a quick question.
Could Buddhism have crossed the path of the teenage Jesus? He is rumored to have disappeared for many years.
The teenage what?
Jesus.
Jesus. Yes, that is another thing that people are saying, is that those 12 years where Jesus disappeared, that he actually went to India and he encountered Buddhism. And I saw a video about this many years ago. I can't remember the name, but somebody has done some research and they did find some texts that mentioned a foreigner with a name like Jesus. I don't know, maybe somebody who's interested can, you know, research it online. But yeah, there's a lot of talk that, you know. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So. Yeah, so there's talk about that too, and you can see some similarities in the doctrine. So quite possible.